Welcome to the Profitable Farmer Podcast, where we share stories and tips to help you run a better farming business and create your very own freedom farm. If you're looking to work smarter and not harder in your farm business, welcome. You're in the right place. G'day and welcome everyone to Profitable Farmer Podcast. I hope this finds you incredibly well. In this podcast, I'm delighted to interview Sarah Crosthwaite. Sarah has recently committed to a Nuffield scholarship looking into the mental health and well-being of farming families and the link that financial stress, climatic variability, and government intervention, amongst other things, can have on the resilience and mental well-being of our farming families. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Sarah to you and just to explore why she committed to this, why Nuffield, what she hopes to research and achieve, and perhaps even also the impact that she hopes that it has in support of, you know, the strength and the success of farming families across our industry. So just as a formal intro, Sarah is an accredited mental health social worker and farms with her husband, Stuart, a dairy farm in northeast Victoria. Sarah has worked as an outreach counsellor to many farmers who were affected by the 2019-2020 Black Summer bushfires. She sits as a farmer representative on the National Centre for Farmer Health Advisory Board, where she continues to advocate for sustainable practices and a holistic approaches to mental health care. Sarah has been a lifeline volunteer and now focuses in on pursuing this Nuffield scholarship. Sarah's research and advocacy focuses on farmers' mental health and well-being, and in a step towards bridging the gap between mental health support and rural communities, Sarah has recently launched her own counselling service tailored specifically for farmers, their families, and farm workers. So in the intro, we'll share some support services that you might find helpful, and we'll also share a link to Sarah's profile and research piece on the Nuffield Scholarship website. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy this. And Sarah, thank you so much for your time. Sarah, thank you so much for your time and welcome to Profitable Farmer Podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Sarah, perhaps just to kick us off, would you mind just sharing your connection to farming and perhaps where you and Stuart find yourselves with your family now?
Absolutely. Well, I lived in Melbourne until I was about 10. And then moved up to Deniliquin with my family when I was young. We bought a small sheep farm just out of Denny, and that was the rest of my sort of childhood, adolescent time was spent there. And then I spent a lot of time around Denny in my early 20s working sort of in and around ag. And then fast forward, I met my husband who was living and working in Warrnambool at the time. We had a couple of years down there and then decided to get married and moved back to his family farm. He's fifth generation on a dairy farm. And we now live in the beautiful Coober Valley in northeast Victoria.
Amazing. And how do you describe the farm that you have and the lifestyle that you and your family enjoy now?
I describe it pretty great. I think we are very lucky. We live predominantly, it's green all year round. We're very fortunate. We have very good, reliable irrigation out of the Coober River. So even when it is hot and dry, I get to look over green paddocks, which is very nice. We're close to Albury Wodonga. We're close to Falls Creek. So I get to, you know, enjoy some skiing in the winter and not too far from major services. But we have a beautiful valley and a really great community. So that's fantastic. It's nice to be back on a farm with so much family kind of history. And we love it. I love the mountains, love Deniliquin, but I have to say I love mountains more, so this is pretty good.
Perfect. And Sarah, how did you stumble upon and launch into a career in social work and counselling?
Good question. Well, I've always kind of loved agriculture and that side of it, but I love people and I love stories. For those that may have known my father, he was a very good storyteller. So I got very good at listening. And while I enjoy the dairy farm side of it, when our youngest Otto was starting school, I thought, I don't know if I really want to milk cows and feed calves every day for the rest of my life. And Stuart's really supportive. So I took myself off to uni in Wodonga at La Trobe and did a Master of Social Work and have been working in that ever since. And, yeah, I've been very fortunate to have a university close by where I was able to do that and a supportive family that let me do that and a farm and a business that was able to support that dream and passion.
What do you reflect on as some of your highlights on that journey, Sarah?
Oh, gee, that's an interesting question. I'm flashing back lots of lowlights of, writing essays and all the hard yards, but I think the highlights really were learning so much more about human development and mindset and understanding trauma and histories of people's lives and how that can impact the present, the past, and the future. So just being able to unpack it and understand it, I think, has been really fascinating and has given me kind of that ability now to kind of look at somebody with absolute no judgment, because we never know what their story is until they share their story. So, I feel very privileged to have, been able to learn that and understand it and unpack it a lot more.
I think you supported people through the Victorian bushfires years ago. How was that experience and how did that play out for you?
Yeah, so that was the 2019-2020 bushfires. That was pretty significant. It touched a lot of people in the Upper Murray and the Northeast, people that were affected by their properties, but also, a lot of CFA members that went out to respond. So it had a huge effect over the whole community. I feel I was in a very privileged seat to be able to work with some amazing people who had been through a lot of adversity and were still prepared to get up every day and keep going, looking after their animals, looking after their land and rebuilding. And they had, multiple challenges because, as you would remember, we had the fires and then very quickly a pandemic hit. So a lot of services, had to pull out because of COVID, but we were fortunate enough that we were seen as essential services. So I got to continue doing face-to-face service with some, amazing people. But, yeah, it was a challenging but very rewarding time.
Sarah, you and I touched on that term resilience. Are you okay to speak to how you reflect on, how you see farming individuals and farming families and what they're capable of achieving?
I smile with the word resilience because it's an important word, but we hear it a lot and I think it gets banned, thrown around probably a bit too much for my liking. I'm yet to meet a farmer that isn't resilient or somebody that works on the land or is connected to it. So telling people to be more resilient, I think, is really insulting. Working with people to highlight their resilience and their strengths and their abilities and to gently remind them of all of them, I think, is a much kinder way to do it. And I think that, as I said, I haven't met a farmer that isn't resilient. Their ability to get up and keep going and care for everything else around them is second to none as far as I'm concerned.
Completely agree. So, Sarah, What inspired you to consider a research piece and an Nuffield project?
Good question. And I think it was sort of during that time of working with a lot of farmers after the bushfires. Generally speaking, in the wider community, you would hear comments like there's no services, there's nothing available. And again, that is true, and it was tricky during COVID. But I wasn't run off my feet. I was busy, but I wasn't flat out. And so it got me thinking, am I not promoting this service well enough? Is our organisation not promoting it well enough? Are people not willing to reach out? You know, what are the barriers and what are the reasons? And I felt that there was support around, so it got me thinking, well, what is it that everybody else is seeing differently to me? And I also think, you know, relatively speaking, we live in a privileged state of Victoria where we don't have to travel vast, vast distances like somebody in Queensland, Western Australia or Northern New South Wales. So I was curious to see if what I was thinking in my mind was happening everywhere or if it was just us and if I had things wrong or different. So that really started the journey, I suppose, because I was interested in it and I thought, well, how can I find out about this? And I was tapped on the shoulder by a few people regarding the Nuffield, and, yeah, that sparked an interest that once it was there, I thought, well, I can't kind of stop thinking about it. So here I am after a journey of getting through the process, but the interview process. But, yes, I'm very fortunate to be here.
Congratulations. And what I'd love to do is just to sort of explore what you're hoping to achieve with your project. And then maybe in 6 months' time or when you feel ready on the other side of your tour and your report perhaps, that we sort of check in again and sort of explore what you did discover on your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I'm hoping to discover is, I think that's a tricky question because I think if I knew what I wanted to discover, I wouldn't be on the journey. So trying to find out different ways of things is important to me. Where it feels sometimes like everybody's doing the same thing, and is that working, is that not? So the great thing about Nuffield is that you get to go overseas and talk to other people in other countries in agriculture and non-agricultural services and ask them what they're doing, what their barriers are, how they've navigated the water, so to speak. So for me, I'm really interested in, yes, what's happening in Australia, but also what's happening everywhere else. Is this an Australian-only issue or is this a world issue? And what are other people doing and what can we take from those learnings to improve and support people through their mental well-being?
So why Nuffield? What was it that had you make that decision that it was a Nuffield research piece that you wanted to do?
Well, Nuffield's all about ag. So even though my Nuffield friends will be laughing if they listen to this because I say I'm more about health science than ag science, but I understand agriculture. I've been around it, you know, nearly my whole life. So I feel like I can relate to people. My core passion and my drive for my work is to predominantly work with farmers and people in agriculture. So that's my market, I suppose. So I want to understand as much as I can about people in agriculture. And as I said, Nuffield is an international scholarship. So I have networks, connections, doors have been open for me that I've been knocking on for many years, and now they open very, very quickly. So yeah, why not?
Perfect. Well done. So, Sarah, there will be some people who are thinking about a Nuffield and wanting to explore that for them. Would What has the process been for you to this point? And then perhaps we can explore what it's going to look like for you over your next 6 or 12 months. But what has been the process for you since you made the decision to apply?
Well, the biggest process was really to have a good research question topic to really understand what it was that I wanted to inquire about. Obviously, then you go through the application process. There's a state interview, which, you know, that in itself is an experience. I hadn't sat really in front of a panel of, I think it was 10 or 12 people, so that was challenging but exciting. You make it hopefully through that round, and then you go to the nationals and, again, another, you know, interview. But then at the nationals, you get a very nice dinner where you get to meet amazing other people that are applying for the same or for other scholarships. So that networking starts very early on, and that was lovely. You don't feel alone. Then I got the award, or was awarded it. So we go to the conference where you're awarded, you meet scholars from the previous years, and you hear recent scholars present their report. So it gives you that understanding of, okay, well, this is going to be me in 18 months' time. I went on a contemporary scholars conference to Canada. That was a 10-day conference, and that's where they bring all the scholars from around the world that have got an Uffield scholarship together. And you're in a room, you know, with like-minded people. They're challenging you, they're pushing you, they're long days, but there's an energy about it that's really exciting, and you meet amazing people, some that I'm about to go and stay with over the next 2 months. I've also been on a global focus tour last year with 11 other scholars, where we went to Argentina, Ireland, France, and Poland. And that was all looking at all sorts of different agriculture, and again, opened my eyes to things that I'd never think I'd see. So that was really amazing. And again, you build great friendships with those 11 other scholars. Yeah, then I've done a lot of my individual research. So I've been to other countries, Canada, New Zealand. I'm about to head to the UK, Germany, Netherlands, Italy, and Switzerland to do more research. And, yeah, that's really exciting. And, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the opportunities that are going to come my way and see what happens.
What's your sense of the Nuffield organisation and that network and kind of how it turns up?
I think it's fantastic. I think it feels like a very big family, a very supportive family. And I know, you know, I've been emailing Carol this week, one of the lovely ladies who sort of does a lot of the admin and behind the scenes stuff, and getting very quick answers and a lot of support. So I also love that you can pick up the phone or send an email to any Nuffield scholar in Australia or across the world and touch base. And every person I've connected with has said, not only, yes, I can help, but I can also give you a bed for the night, or how about I organise this tour, or how about I do that as well. So just the generosity that you get from the network is, yeah, it's fantastic. And not only for me, I've taken my family with me, and they've been very supportive to all of us. So it's lovely. And we've opened our doors and had, you know, visitors here, which is equally as exciting.
Thanks, Sarah. So can you explain your project, what it is focusing in on, and perhaps where you're up to in that research so far?
Yeah. So my topic is broadly looking at mental health and wellbeing in farming communities, and where it ends up will be different to where it starts. Initially, you know, I somewhat naively felt this massive responsibility that I had to solve the mental health crisis of regional Australia. I've worked out pretty quickly that I'm not going to be able to do that. But what I have sort of done, or really looked at, is there's a lot of literature, you know, in journal articles, academic articles, but also if you look at general reports and surveys that come out, there's some key themes that we keep hearing about, and they're usually around financial stress, unpredictable weather, and changes in changes in government rules, regulations, and those what that impact will then have on farmers. So they're the kind of the themes that I've been looking at or that you hear about, but then it got me thinking more and more about them. So then I've kind of got interested in mental health promotion, service delivery, and then really become quite interested in the financial literacy, which links back to that kind of common theme. So far I've been talking to, you know, multiple people around mental health promotion, service delivery, financial literacy, what's in our control and what's not in our control, and trying to understand what are the major issues and what are the major links and what are the major ways that we can support to reduce some of that accumulated stress that either comes due to financial situations, weather, or, you know, potential changes in rules and regulations.
And so how far through, you mentioned that you've been to New Zealand and you've done some touring around Australia and had one or two other trips. How far into this are you, and what's next for you over the next sort of 6 and 12 months?
Yeah, well, yes. So I've been to Canada and a few other trips overseas in New Zealand. The trip that I'm about to do, I was meant to do last year, but we had the family issue that meant that I had to postpone that. So I'm doing this trip quite late towards the end. So this will be a big trip with meeting a lot of people, and then I will come back and lock myself in a dark room with no distractions and write a report, sort of summarizing and putting all of my case studies and findings together. And then that needs to be written by the end of July, and then I present that at the Nuffield conference in Launceston in September.
Right, so the deadlines are arriving.
The deadline is arriving, Jeremy. Yes, a lot quicker than I thought, but that's good. So it's, yes, giving me a lot of time and space to interview and talk to a vast array of people, but now it's time to pull it out of the many notebooks and get it down onto paper, which will be fun.
So we talk with our members about, yes, there are things that are outside of our control in this game, price and yield and, as you say, government intervention, et cetera, but that there is so much that we can control. And one of the things that we can control is the strength of our financial acumen and our ability to understand our numbers and then analyse the key decisions or key changes that we're making. Do you have any sort of broad insights about the importance of good financial literacy and how it can help people's mental well-being and mental health?
What I have found, I spent a lot of time with a lady in Canada, and they're doing a lot of work around that financial literacy and understanding your numbers. And their approach to kind of farmer mental health is really to take the mental health side out of it and really focus on the financial literacy and understanding. Generally speaking, we know that majority of farmers are kind of, you know, over 45, 50, 60, maybe have finished school but don't have a higher education, don't have a great understanding around the finances, maybe took over the books from their father or mother-in-law. So they might be very good at growing grass, producing milk, food, fiber, or fodder, but don't really have that understanding around the financial literacy. So when people that I've interviewed who were maybe at that end of the spectrum, so to speak, who have gone on and taken the time to learn about their business more so than just, you know, doing the admin side of it, but knowing their benchmarking and their numbers, and then have had an adverse event happen to them. Yes, it's stressful, absolutely, because that's life and we're never not going to have stresses. But because they've been able to know their numbers and they've been able to build some sort of business plan when things were okay, they're able to respond to that pressure in a more positive way. So it's still going to be stressful for them. It's still going to be difficult, but they have noticed that they don't do the bad habits that they might have done once before, that they can deal with it and they can move through it a lot quicker, and all things that might have once been really stressful and caused a lot of stress in their life now is kind of like a blimp on the radar. They deal with it better. So that then means that they have better relationships with their family and friends, and they're able to move forward. So I think that's really interesting. And in New Zealand, there's a lot of different stuff going on there, but they're also doing a lot of work where an organization's got a number of retired accountants and financial advisors that are coming in and actually sitting down and giving some farmers kind of some one-on-one support and education around financial literacy and understanding it so that people can make better decisions.
What else are you seeing in this space overseas? You mentioned Canada and other parts of the world. Have you seen some other examples of communities really focusing in on this and doing it well?
No, is the honest truth. Not so far. But as I said, I'm excited to be going to the UK and the Netherlands. So there's a bit of stuff happening there. There's, but I can probably tell you more once I've been back. Like I can, you know, I know a little bit, but I suspect I'll know a lot more in another month or two.
And what's your comment on Australian farmers and our strength in financial literacy? Do you, I know it's a broad question and some people are all over it and really strong on this, but I guess what we see is that there are a lot of farmers, as you say, that haven't been to ag college or haven't been to uni or haven't sort of studied this stuff, and you know, they inherit the books and the accounts and don't really have a good level of mastery in this area. Do you have a comment on the strength or otherwise of this in our industry?
I often joke to my husband that when I said my vows, they should have said for better, for worse, for bookkeeper or not, because I, you know, did Year 10 maths and I think I spent most of my time looking out the window, if I was really honest. And I am one of those people. I've fallen into this role of being the bookkeeper and doing the financials and have found it challenging for many years because it's not a skill set that I'm necessarily interested in or understand. I'm lucky that Stuart is very interested in it and does understand a lot of it, so he picks up a lot of the slack. But the more people I talk to, or the when I talk to farmers who come to see me for counselling, one of the main stresses is always around financial uncertainty and not knowing, and the feeling the pressure of having to do BASAs and having to, you know, get things reported, and not wanting to do it because for whatever reason they might struggle, you know, poor literacy, financial, or, you know, any other kind of issue. So I think you're right that there are more and more people younger. You know, I really look at the younger kind of generation and think we've really got agriculture well set up. We're going to be fine as a country. But there's still a lot of people in the middle who are really struggling. But there are great programs and organisations are trying really hard to improve that. I know Dairy Australia is doing a lot with Our Farm, Our Plan, which is getting people to start putting things down and understand that. So the more we continue to do that and the more we talk about it, the more people hopefully are willing to put their hand up and say, oh, actually, this isn't my greatest skill set. Maybe I should improve it.
So, Sarah, we talk about financial literacy and farmers needing to skill up around their numbers. And I'm absolutely, I think FOA as a team, we're big on this. We completely think that that's a priority to help farming families feel like they're in control and making really strong decisions that support their sense of self and their success. But I guess just what I'd love to clarify is, you know, we tell farmers they need to be better at finances and you mentioned bookkeeping. I can imagine that farmer who goes into the office to, you know, to do that and then gets lost in data entry and compliance and BAS and, you know, all that probably feels worse for going into the office rather than better. Are we actually wanting them to do that? Or do you think that is something that we should be, you know, potentially delegating to a bookkeeper so that our farming or farm business owners can focus in on meaningful budgeting, meaningful benchmarking, you know, analysing decisions and using those skills or learning those skills to actually take a leadership role in how they move forward? I hope I'm being clear there.
I hear exactly what you're saying, and I think you're right that we don't want to be doing the $25 jobs when we could be doing the $100 jobs, so to speak. However, I think we have, you know, a cohort of farmers that maybe don't actually know how to do that benchmarking and how to do that higher strategical thinking around their business because they're so daunted by the everyday bookkeeping and or even that's too difficult for them. So they stay out in the paddock and then, you know, bills don't get paid on time and so forth. And so then there's that kind of ripple effect that goes through. So, yes, it's about kind of pushing into that leadership role of thinking more strategically about your business. But I think you have to kind of really crawl before you can walk and really understand that early part. So I think that there's a need for promotion and support around A, B, and C, and then the rest. And it might be that the farming family comes together and things get split and divided. So one partner becomes kind of the everyday bookkeeper, tracks what needs to happen, and the other person's able to then move on and further up. And or, yes, I think if people can bring bookkeepers in admin roles. I know I was talking to a farmer in Ireland who told me, you know, he needs another dairy hand, but what he really needs is somebody to be sitting in the office helping doing all the paperwork because there's so many rules and compliances and forms that need to be filled out in the EU now that's a whole other task and a skill set that he doesn't have the time or the energy to do. So if we can outsource resource, I think absolutely great. And, you know, so I'm always saying to people, there's so many different roles in agriculture. You don't have to actually be the farmer in the paddock. You might be somebody that's really interested in bookkeeping or business management and you can sort of support farmers. I think we need to be looking at what we're good at and what we're not. And if we can outsource, then definitely do that.
Yeah, great comment. Thank you. So then turning our attention to the mental health side of things, often hear that there's a real shortage of services in support of farming families and regional communities around and supporting mental health challenges. Do you agree with that? What would your comment be?
I think that's a great question, and I probably sit on the fence a little bit. I think we do a very good job in the rural context around promoting mental health, wellbeing, and wellness. Across the whole of Australia, this was a conversation that nobody would have 10 years ago, and we talk about it a lot. We see football players talk about it, people in the media. So the conversation is really changing, and there is a lot of mental health promotion happening in farming communities. I think the issue we have is that the delivery of mental health services and support for people who aren't on their A game or aren't feeling that they can get the support from their family or friends and might need something more formal, I think we have an issue in that space. That yes, we know in regional and rural communities that most of us don't have a local GP because we've got locums coming in, so it's hard to build a relationship, which means it's hard to open up and share vulnerabilities. We know we don't have a psychologist or mental health social worker on every corner. So there are barriers, but there are also other things that are happening in this space that can support people. So telehealth has become a big thing. So because farmers are resilient and adaptable, we as service providers and clinicians need to be thinking differently on the way that we deliver mental health services and support. If COVID taught us one thing, it taught us how to all pretty much do Zoom. Whether you're doing it for a meeting or it was to say hi to the grandkids, in Melbourne or wherever, most of us now, we might not all be comfortable with it, but we can have a conversation the way that we once wouldn't have done. So we've adapted to moving with technology and delivery of programs and services. So I would like to see a better emphasis when people do mental health promotion to really talking about what services are available in your local community rather than in a national community. There's definitely national services like TX, like Rural Health Connect, Rural Aid that can support farmers, but there are also in communities, smaller regional communities, there are health services. It's about promoting them in your area. And for me, when people do mental health promotion, I'd love to see them really sort of at the end of it saying, in your local area, you have A, B, and C. Or you don't unfortunately have any services, but these are services that are available with a rural connection, a rural understanding, a rural lens, because we know that farmers want to talk to people that understand agriculture. They don't want to talk to somebody that's never stepped in a paddock. So that those things are available.
Yeah, there's an opportunity there that they're more available now than they ever have been because of teleconferencing and, we've all got access to potentially all the support we need now that we didn't have 10 or 15 years ago when there was only local support. But to your point, I think it's sometimes hard for people to know who to reach out to or what call to make or what request to make, given that we do have access to so many potential support services.
Absolutely. And, I've been researching and working on this for over a year and a half now, and I'm still struggling to find services, or I find somebody today that I didn't know about 2 days ago and I think, how did I not know? Like, I should know because I'm spending so much of my time looking into this. So things are changing and adapting quickly, and I need to be really clear. I know people in remote Western Australia aren't going to have good connectivity, so there are definitely barriers for people like that more than people in the Kiwa Valley. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, and that was probably back to my point earlier on when I first thought I have to fix the whole mental health problem. I can't, unfortunately. And not everything that I find or everything that I suggest or somebody else suggests is going to work, because not everything works for everybody all the time. But the more options we have, the more variety, and the more we let people know about it, then they can hopefully be brave enough to go, you know what, I'm going to pick up the phone and try that phone number, or I might try that telehealth, or I might read that article and see if that helps me.
Thanks, Sarah. So perhaps just a couple of final questions. Do you have a hope or an aspiration of the impact that your research might have back on the industry?
Yeah, I do. I hope, and I'm quietly confident, Jeremy, that industry is taking notice and listening. I think the agriculture industry is amazing, and we produce wonderful food and fibre and fodder and whatever. But if we don't have the people growing and producing all of that, we don't have an industry. We can bring robots in and we can mechanize things as much as possible, but we still need people at the end of the day. So the number one asset to any farm and any business is its people. So to me, the agriculture industry, whether it be the dairy industry or the meat and livestock or whatever, they need to be going, how is it that we can support the people who are helping us to produce all of this food and fibre so that we can will continue to prosper in this industry? So once we can get those connections and those that thought process, and I think it is happening, there's some really great stuff happening in the grain industry, in the dairy industry, there is stuff happening. The more we talk about it and the more support and the more collaboration, I think if we can sort of stop working in silos and work collaboratively, then it's not only better for the individual farmer, but it's better for the whole of the agriculture sector and then the whole of Australia and, you know, everybody. So that's got to be good, doesn't it?
It's really important work, Sarah. And, yeah, I can only imagine that on the other side of this research and as you sort of come to your final findings, that it will have an impact as you just described. So well done.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, just asking you to put your therapist hat on for a moment. If anyone listening feels like they're not on their A game, or if there's someone that they see in their family or in their team or in their community that they feel is not on their A game, what would you have them do?
That's a great question. And it's different for everyone. But if it's a family member noticing it, I would actually gently point out what you've noticed. I've noticed that you're not connecting with the family. I noticed that you seem to be tired. I noticed that you're coming in later than usual. I noticed that you're drinking a few more beers than what's normal. I noticed that you're not connecting with your friends, and I'm concerned about that. How can I help? What can I help with? So asking that, when you give people permission to know that they're, sorry, that doesn't make sense. When people have the permission to speak because they feel that they've been seen, they might open up, they might close down. That's the gamble. But if we say nothing, if we notice it but we don't acknowledge it, we can't help. So it's about trying to show people that you notice that something's not right, because it plants the seed. It might take them a little bit longer to open up to you, but generally they will. And if you're a person who might be feeling all of the things that I just described, it is about finding somebody, and that can actually be harder than we think, because often we say talk to a mate, talk to your partner. Now, I can't tell you how many times I've spoken with farmers, people in rural lives who go, I don't want to talk to my mate because my mate's my next door neighbour and he's going through the same thing. And or if I talk to him, then it all becomes about him and I feel worse or I don't feel heard. Sometimes we don't want to talk to our partner because we don't want to put the burden on them. Even though it's not a burden, it can feel like a burden. So if you're feeling like that and you feel like you can't talk to anybody in your close circle, that's okay. And it's okay to acknowledge that. But the next step is to be brave enough to say, I need to now talk to somebody else and I need to reach out. And there are services, maybe we can put a link in the show notes or whatever at the end, but there are services like TX, this is a conversation starter, where they have counsellors that you can talk to on telehealth or over the phone, or you can text them. There are other services like Rural Health Connect, where you can connect with psychologists. There's also, you know, Rural Aid. There are psychologists online. There are different services. So it's about kind of being brave enough to move forward. There's a saying, and I don't know who said it, but it's the fear that you face will leave you, but the fear that you run from will always follow you. So it's about sort of saying, I don't feel right. This isn't good for me. Do I want to keep my head in the sand and soldier on? Or do I actually want to unburden myself and get some support? And what I find is that if you are brave enough to actually talk to somebody earlier, you might only need two or three conversations to feel a lot better, but it's when we hold it in for such a long period of time that it takes more work to work through.
Thanks, Sarah. Just an extension of that, I remember in a previous conversation that you mentioned that you have had and have dyslexia. I just find it amazing that you're leaning into a really intricate research piece, and no doubt there's a significant report written or otherwise at the end of that. Congratulations on leaning into this for so many reasons, but just well done for doing it, given that that is sort of a learning challenge that you might have navigated. What would you say to people that might think that something like a Nuffield or, you know, an ag degree or whatever might not be available to them because they might have a learning difficulty or a challenge like that?
Yeah, great question. And I did, for many years, I did everything in my power and ability to hide my dyslexia and to kind of run for it and ignore it. But it's there and it's part of me. And, you know, with age, wisdom, maybe not, I've been able to push through that, so it's still with me. And every day there are challenges, but I have had so much more reward from pushing myself to do challenging things than from sitting in fear of, well, what if somebody laughs at me? What if somebody thinks I'm no good because of my learning disability? I don't see it as a disability. I see it as a power and a strength now. I'm pretty open and honest about it. You know, it gets you out of writing minutes in staff meetings, so that's good if you tell everyone. But yes, you're right. At the moment, I, you know, am doing a lot of research, a lot of reading, which is fine, but a lot of writing. And I struggle to get it from my mind onto paper. But I continue to do it because the reward that I feel when I've done it, written something or put it down, is far better than the feeling I have of failure or not being able to do something. So I would say to anybody who's thinking about doing a Nuffield or thinking about going to university or any of those big kind of things, you will feel much better once you do. It will be challenging, but nothing worth doing isn't challenging, right? So, yes, it's hard, but it's fun and it's rewarding. And the feeling of accomplishment, I think, is, to me, is kind of what keeps me going. I've got two teenage kids now. And for me, it's been about showing them that it doesn't really matter who, what differences we have. If you keep trying and you get up, you know, we get knocked down, but you get back up again, right? So yeah, don't let dyslexia or anything like that ever put you off following your dreams, because we are all worth it.
That's a great comment, Sarah. Thank you. Congratulations on committing to this. a major piece of work that I think is going to be really compelling. Would it be okay if we connected again on the other side of your touring and your researching and your report writing, and we can explore some of the key outcomes that come from your project?
Absolutely. Love to. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. So great to connect with Sarah Crosthwaite and to explore a really important topic. And just credit to you, Sarah, for pioneering and being so committed to this research piece. I look forward to debriefing with you and to a follow-up podcast, perhaps in 6 or 12 months when you feel ready, just to share some of the key takeaways and insights. But amazing to think that there's that piece of research being done around, you know, mental health and well-being of farmers and how that is impacted by financial stress, by climatic variability, and by the impositions of government on our farms and our businesses and our industries. Again, Sarah, thank you for your time. Congratulations. And to all of you, I hope that's been valuable. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Profitable Farmer Podcast by Farm Owners Academy. If you're new to this show, be sure to follow us. If you've been a long-time listener, let your friends know about us or come continue the conversation in the Profitable Farmer Facebook group. All the best as you grow your business and create your freedom farm. Until next time, keep being incredible.